have really spent most of my career trying to bridge cultural divides. So my mom's Egyptian, my dad's French, and it was always a lot of fun in our household when we got into arguments. So I'm hoping I can bring some of those skills here with you and excited to be part of this commission. Dustin.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Yeah. Good seeing everybody again. I feel like it's been a while, but again, my name is Dustin Kong. I'm the content and project specialist for the division. I oversee our Magnify Utah program, which is focused on building up those resources. It's our resource and learning hub, connecting communities, places, and stories.
Hello, everyone. I'm Megan Castleton. I'm the Communications and Marketing Coordinator here for the division. You probably have seen me in some of these meetings. And, you know, I add that final sparkle and flair to a lot of our programs and projects, and just happy to be here and part of this conversation.
Good afternoon, Tracy Gruber, Executive Director at the Utah Department of Health and Human Services, and was, I guess, overly excited to be back in the former Department of Health building.
And hi, everyone. My name is Jenny Howe, and I'm the Logistics and Project Coordinator here at the Division of Multicultural Affairs, and I specifically oversee our grants program. And then if you want, Sean, I can just popcorn it over to individuals I see online. Is that okay with you?
That'd be great.
Great. I'm going to choose you, Rihanna.
Hi, everybody. Rihanna here in Moab at the Moab Valley Multicultural Center. Happy to be back with you all and step into the new period of time in this commission. So thanks.
Elliot, do you want to go next?
Sure. Yeah, we're kind of all doing the Brady Bunch thing. We don't know who's where, but... I'm Elliot Clark. I'm the Assistant Attorney General who represents this body, and I'm here today because I'm going to be doing the public meetings training, which is always everyone's favorite. So nice to meet you all.
Thank you.
And Karis, why don't you go ahead?
Hi, my name is Sarah Staffer. I'm here in Logan, Northern Utah. I'm happy to be here today and to continue what we've started.
Daniel?
Hey, Daniel Strong. I'm Director of the Sentencing Commission with the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice. I come from a career background as a prosecutor mainly, although I was a defense attorney as well for a little while, but I've been in this policy role for about 4 years. I also work on judicial appointments for the governor, as Sean knows. Good to see you, Sean. And we will, I guess that's it. Thank you. I'll turn my camera on once I'm finished with lunch. Sorry to keep it off.
And then we just had someone join by phone. If you would mind introducing yourself.
Yep. Sorry, this is Rich Knight, Senior Advisor to Governor Cox. I'm just driving through rural Utah, and the Google Meet link I apparently is not carrying enough bandwidth to support. So I jumped on my phone and was kicked out of the Google Meet for lack of connection.
No problem. Thank you, Dr. Knight. Sean, do you want to introduce yourself?
I think it's me. Sean Newell. I am fortunate to be the co-chair of the commission with Luna. I've been involved in a lot of different things here in the state and in our communities, and just looking forward to continue to do the work and elevating the work that's being done here by the commission.
And I think Luna is coming up in the elevator. But I think we can probably move on and have her introduce herself when she gets here.
Well, Igor, it's your turn. I mean, you'll get a chance later on, too.
I thought I started out, but I can go again. Igor Lemansky, Director of Multicultural Affairs. Really excited to be here with you all.
Wonderful. So I think we'll skip the roll call because we don't have a quorum. Is that okay with everyone?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, great. So has everybody had a chance to review the minutes from our last meetings?
Yes.
Okay, great. And we can't even vote on the approval of that without a quorum, so we'll hold tight on that. And excuse me, go ahead. Okay, so, alrighty. And the next item, as part of just getting things kicked off, is we have a vacancy here on the commission, and we wanted everybody to put forth some names of potential commissioners. We have until the end of the month. I think we decided on Jenny, correct, and Igor?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
To the end of this month to submit some names. And what we're looking for are people that are involved in the community, people that want to serve our state and our multicultural communities and that have a passion for doing this work. So anybody that you can think of, folks that you believe will be available to be able to work with us and help us and be consistent, those are the kind of folks we're looking for. So keep that in mind, and if you can, submit those names before the end of the year. But there's a process. I don't want to skip over the process. There's an application process that they have to go through, and they can also find that information on the state website. Am I correct in that? It's the state website, because I looked it up, but I can't remember. And there's a couple of different links you have to go through, but they'll have to go through that process to apply, and then from there they'll be vetted for the commission. Any questions on that?
Yeah, this is Tracy, Sean. Just one question. Is this a special commission vacancy? Like, it has to be from this particular population or rural or anything like that, or is it just open-ended?
My understanding is that at this point it's open-ended. There isn't okay. specific.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
we're
you.
We're all special, Tracy.
That's right. Thank you.
All righty. Well, I guess that'll leave.
Do you want to take a moment to introduce yourself?
Okay.
Sure. My name is Luna Benuri. Repeated often enough here. I am currently work-wise with Sundance Institute, but also represent the Muslim community and founded an organization called Utah Muslim Civic League, which is the advocacy organization. And through that, we've done a lot of sort of incisive work in the community. And I'm happy to be here and starting this, like somebody else used the word, the second phase of the Multicultural Commission. And note to myself, you know, Zoom meetings and switching to in-person meeting does need a time zone. You can't actually just transport yourself. So apologies for being late.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Great. Glad you're here. But I wish I were there too. I messed up. So, next, we're going to hear from Elliot Clark on this OPMA training. This is something that's really important. It's something that we all have to do. And thank you, Elliot, for being here to be able to do this for us.
Yes, thank you. So, yeah, every public body has to have this training once a year. And so I've just got a presentation I'm going to do. And it's as abbreviated as it can be, but it still hits all the high points. So I hope I've struck a good balance. But as I go through, I might not see hands raised or anything, but if you have questions, by all means, just speak up and let me know. And with that, I will share my screen. Okay, does that look right? So, Utah Open and Public Meetings Act, or OPMA is what we call it. So, hold on. Supposed to be, there we go. Sorry about that. So what is OPMA? So it's just the statute that provides requirements for how meetings of public officials have to happen. The main thing is it requires an open and deliberative process before any public body votes on any matter under its jurisdiction. The main things to take away from this slide is that all votes have to be taken in public, meaning in an open session. There are circumstances when you can close a meeting to the public. We'll talk about that later. But no votes can ever happen in those closed sessions. It applies to public bodies. So what is a public body? It's very broadly defined. You are a public body because you are created by a Utah statute. You have two or more individuals. You expend, disburse, or are supported, at least in part, by tax revenue. And you have authority to make decisions about the public's business, which makes you subject to OPMA. It only applies when there is a meeting of a public body. So what is a meeting? This is the definition of meeting under OPMA. It's a gathering with a quorum present for the express purpose of acting as a public body to receive comment about, deliberate about, or take action on a relevant matter. The key definition there is relevant matter. So what is, Relevant matter is defined, I'll just tell you, as any matter in your jurisdiction that you have authority to act over. What is a quorum? It's a simple majority of the membership of a public body. Your statute doesn't say otherwise, so it's just a simple majority. And here's the relevant matter slide. A matter within the scope of the authority of a public body. Again, you'll see this is very broad. If we go back to the definition here of what a meeting is, something to point out, it happens when you receive comment about, deliberate about, or take action on a relevant matter. So one question we get a lot is, well, a quorum is going to be there, but we're not going to be taking votes, so is it still a meeting? You don't have to take a vote for it to still be a meeting. You can see there in the definition, anytime you have a quorum present to receive comment about or deliberate about a relevant matter, that is still a meeting. So as a general rule of thumb, I've put this down here at the bottom. When in doubt, when there's a quorum, just assume it's a meeting and notice it as a meeting. That's really the easiest way to go about it and be safe. Before any meeting, there has to be a notice. You are required to post a Class A notice. Class B notice applies to certain smaller bodies. A Class A notice has to be posted at least 24 hours in advance of each meeting on the public notice website. In addition, if the public body has an official website and a budget of at least $250,000, that posting also has to be made on the official website. The notice has to include an agenda, and the key thing for the agenda is that they must be worded with, quote, reasonable specificity. That's not really defined in statute, but the way we look at it is enough specificity for the average person to be able to pick up the agenda, read it, and know what you were going to discuss and what actions you're going to take. In addition to that, to the 24-hour requirement, if you schedule your meetings in advance over the course of a year, so if you already know, for example, all of your meeting dates through the end of 2025, you also need to post those calendar dates on the public notice website. As for what records need to be kept of open meetings, you have to take an audio recording and written minutes. Even though there is going to be an audio recording of every meeting, though, the approved written minutes are the official record of your meetings. This is a list of what has to be in the written minutes. So just standard things you would expect: date, time, and place, the name of all commissioners who are present and absent. This one is worth touching on. So substance of all matters proposed, discussed, or decided by the public body. I get questions a lot of times, you know, how much detail is required there? Again, OTMA doesn't really specify how much detail. Just remember, the idea is that someone needs to be able to pick up the minutes out of the blue and see what was discussed, what votes were taken, how different commissioners voted. There just needs to be an accurate representation of what happened at the meeting. So as long as the minutes cover that, it's fine. It does not have to be a word-for-word transcription. So I've actually seen some public bodies do that. It's essentially a word-for-word transcription. And you can do that, but it's just an awful lot of work. So as long as it's enough detail where this is covered, this third bullet point, then you're fine. In addition, if anyone from the public shows up to the meeting to make a public comment, the minutes also have to have that person's name and the substance of the comment. As for posting the minutes and the audio recording, so the audio recording has to get posted within 3 days after the meeting. Pending minutes, meaning draft unapproved minutes, those have to be available 30 days after the meeting. And then once minutes are approved, then you have 3 business days to post those approved written minutes on the public notice website. Electronic meetings are allowed. An electronic meeting under OTMA is just any meeting when there's an electronic option. So even if, you know, 12 of 13 commissioners are in person, if one commissioner attends online, then it becomes an electronic meeting. You do still have to provide your standard notice and all of that. You have to post the agenda. None of that changes. A relatively new change to point out here, this is, I think, 2023 or 24 when this happened. you do not have to provide a physical anchor location if all members of the public body attend electronically. So it used to be that even if all members of the public body zoomed in, there needed to be a physical anchor location, but that's not the case anymore. But you'll note that it says if all members of the public body attend electronically. So if even just two or three of you want to be there in person, you need to provide that anchor location. This is an exception to that rule, but I've never seen it happen. But let's say you were not going to have a physical anchor location. It was going to be purely electronic. If you got a written request from a member of the public, say, at least 12 hours before the start of the meeting, then you would need to provide a physical anchor location. But again, haven't seen that happen. Electronic message transmissions, this one is important. So under OTMA, it specifically says that there's no restriction that prohibits members of the public body from transmitting messages to each other when the public body is not in session. But remember what we mentioned earlier, anytime a quorum is discussing, deliberating about a relevant matter, that really needs to be taking place in a meeting. Because again, you do not have to actually take a vote for it to be a meeting. So if you're going to do G-chats or group text threads or, you know, reply all emails, all of that is fine. You just want to make sure that there's one less than a quorum on those threads. Because as soon as you're replying all and you have a quorum discussion, that's when you need to be in an open meeting. So just be mindful of that. Emergency meetings, you can have meetings with less than 24 hours notice. This is very rare. It still requires the best notice practicable under the circumstances. You can see here the standard example we use is like a broken water line, something that absolutely cannot wait 24 hours. But if it can wait 24 hours, just notice it up like a regular meeting. Closed meetings, this is what I mentioned earlier. There are times when you can close meetings to the public, even with a quorum. There's a procedure for that. So first you have to start out in an open meeting. Someone has to make a motion to close the meeting, and that motion has to name the specific statutory purpose that allows you to close. At that point, you take a roll call vote, and 2/3 of the quorum needs to approve closing the meeting. Any vote, as you know, is usually just a majority of the quorum, but OTMA does specifically say that to close a meeting, it has to be 2/3 of the quorum. This is a list of the most common reasons a meeting can be closed. This is not exhaustive. If you look in 52-4-205, there's probably 30 or 35 reasons, but these are the most common ones. This first one especially is common. So to discuss character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of an individual. You see that a lot with hiring and firing decisions, for example. If there's a public body that needs to make a hiring decision, you can close a meeting to do a job interview or to discuss John Smith's qualifications. You can do that not in public. But again, remember that because all votes need to be taken in public, you would still reopen and vote to hire or fire John Smith in public. This third one is, you know, we see it sometimes, to discuss pending or reasonably imminent litigation, to discuss the purchase of real property. So these are just some of the things. As for what kind of a record you have to make of a closed meeting, usually you do still make an audio recording, and people wonder about that. The purpose of making an audio recording of a closed session is that if someone comes back later and challenges your closing the meeting, for example, if they sue and say you shouldn't have closed the meeting, there needs to be that audio recording for a judge to listen to determine whether you properly closed the meeting, whether you took any action in the meeting that you shouldn't have, that kind of thing. So you do still need that audio recording. Minutes are optional. You do not have to create minutes of a closed meeting. Something else to point out, if you close a meeting for that first purpose I mentioned, character, physical or mental health, or professional competence, you don't have to even do an audio recording. If you close for that purpose, what happens is the chair of the body just signs a statement that says, we closed for this purpose on this day, and this was the only thing we did. And you just post that sworn statement to the public notice website, and that takes care of it. That's all the record you need. Again, what is forbidden during a closed meeting? Basically, everything except discussion. Just keep that in mind. If you close a meeting, you can talk, and that's really it. If someone violates OTMA, this goes back to what I was talking about. This is why you need an audio recording. So a court can void any action that's taken in violation of the law. Sometimes the fix is really easy, right? I mean, if someone complains to the AG's office that such and such public body took an action, but they didn't do 24 hours notice, that's an easy fix. You call up the public body, they just do it again, where they redo their work. But there are certain circumstances when that's not enough, and, you know, court cases do arise from there. This last bullet I want to point out, this just sort of drives home the importance of the closed meeting provisions. So in addition to any other penalty under OTMA, a member of a public body, so any of you commissioners who intentionally violate or intentionally abet or advise in violation of the closed meeting provisions, is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor. So you can see that's punishable by 6 months in jail and or up to a $1,000 fine. So just keep in mind, if you're going to close a meeting, absolutely there are circumstances when you can do it, but you want to make sure you're following the statutory procedure and you're doing it for a statutorily permitted purpose. Remedies and enforcement. So if someone violates OTMA, if a public body violates OTMA, what can happen? Well, again, this first bullet, any action taken in violation of OTMA is voidable by a court of competent jurisdiction. You'll see that this is a pretty quick turnaround. It's a 90-day statute of limitations. So if someone is going to challenge, you know, an action under OTMA in court, they only have 90 days from the date of that action. So it's pretty fast. Under OTMA, the Attorney General's Office and every county attorney throughout the state have authority to enforce OTMA. In addition, any person denied a right by an action taken by the public body may sue to compel compliance. So basically, anyone allegedly aggrieved by a public body's action can sue under OTMA. If the aggrieved party is successful, they may recover attorney's fees from the public body. This one, is luckily, we don't have to deal with this often, but public meetings are presumed open to the public. I mean, that's the idea behind the Open and Public Meetings Act. And a certain amount of, you know, heated discussion may take place at any given meeting. That's okay. That's to be expected. But if there's a person in the audience or, you know, an attendee who is so disruptive that you just can't conduct the meeting, OTMA does allow you to remove that person from the meeting. But it is, just keep in mind, that's a pretty high bar. You can see here, OTMA says that they have to be willfully disruptive to the extent that orderly conduct is seriously compromised. And usually in today's world, removing a person from a meeting just means blocking their Zoom access. So it's pretty easy to do. Training, the chair of each public body has to ensure that you get yearly training, so that's why I'm here. And in closing, just kind of some final bullets to keep in mind. These are the most common violations we see. Again, the closed meetings, that's really the biggie. No votes at all in a closed meeting. And if you're going to close a meeting, do it the right way and for the right reason. Also notice, we get complaints about that a lot, the 24-hour notice. And then sometimes we get complaints about public bodies' failure to post minutes or audio recordings in a timely fashion. So in conclusion, just take these bullets with you. These are the key things. So 24-hour notice, agenda items need to be reasonably specific. Again, that's not really defined, but it just needs to be enough to know what's going to happen. Err on the side of transparency. What I mean by that is, you know, let's say you have 10 agenda items you hope to cover. You don't think you're going to get to them all, but so you just put 6 or 7 on the agenda. And then at the end of those 6 or 7, you realize, shoot, we have time to do these other things, but it's not on the agenda. Just because something is on the agenda does not mean you have to take action on it. So if you have 10 agenda items and you can only get to 4, fine. But you certainly can't take action on an item if it's not on the agenda. So just put it all on there. And if you can't get to it all, that's okay. And then here's really the catch-all. Any questions? Consult legal counsel. And that's me. And that's the entire presentation, but I'm happy to answer questions if you have any.
Elliot, I do have a question for you. Does a designee count towards a quorum?
So, depends on how the statute is worded. Some statutes will say this public body has X members, and one of the members is such and such a person or designee. If it says that, then yes. What I think you may be talking about is sort of like a one-time delegee or representative to a meeting, right? So this particular board member can't make it today, so I'm sending John Smith in my place to sort of report back to me on what's happening. Certainly, they can send a person to report back. I mean, it's a public meeting, so of course that's okay. But that person can't then act as a board member. So, for example, if a board member can't make it today and they sent somebody in their place, that's fine, but then that person is not all of a sudden a substitute board member. They can't vote, and they don't count towards a quorum.
But if they're the designee for the individual, then it counts, if it's written that way in the statute.
Right, right. And I don't believe your statute permits designees. I've got it pulled up. It doesn't seem to permit designees. So, but again, by all means, I mean, no board member can attend every meeting, so they may want to send a representative, and that's fine. But just keep in mind that that representative can't then act as a board member.
They can't act as a board member, but do they count towards a quorum?
No, because they're not a board member.
Got it.
All right. And with that, I'm going to hop off. But again, any questions that come up today or over the course of any subsequent meetings, I'm here. Email me, call me. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
See you next year.
See ya.
So I just wanted to take a moment to give us an opportunity to get to know each other a little bit. I feel like there is this work that we're doing here is tremendously important, and there's an opportunity to revitalize this commission. And I think the way that we're going to do that is to get to know each other a little better. And so I just wanted the opportunity to have a question that we all go around and answer. Keep in mind that we are tight on time. So think of it as like a one breath answer. And we'll just go around the table and answer this question. What's one cultural value or practice from your family or community that has shaped who you are? And I can start, and I'll just say that a big family practice for us was cooking and eating together. And for me, it's something that I still do now. My wife did not grow up with that tradition, but it's one that we literally do every day. We cook together, we sit at a meal together, and it's really shaped the way I appreciate being with community members, which is cooking and eating together.
I'm still thinking.
Okay. Dustin, go
ahead. I think a big thing for me is unconditional support. I think something that was always promoted in my family is even though we never really understood what one another was always going through, we were always there to show up, to always support one another, no matter what it was, however we could, we were always there and present.
I think a practice, I immediately went to a specific tradition. So for the holidays, we specifically do a cheese and chocolate fondue. And that actually started because when my grandmother divorced her husband, she had four kids to take care of. It was the holidays. She didn't have a lot of money to afford things. So she made it special by having it be this, you know, special thing. Like, we're going to eat together. We're going to share together. It's going to be something very special. We've carried that on now. And I think that's a very nice practice of it's not about the money. It's about what we do for each other and how we support each other. And I think that's a very important value. And I think it shaped me by giving me a immense love of cheese as well.
So Tracy, DHHS, I am going to go with family, cooking and eating together. Whether or not it's around the holidays or just making sure that every night when our kids were younger, we got together and I spent time teaching my kids how to cook before I re-entered the workforce. And, yeah, something we stuck with.
I think for me, something that my community has taught me is the importance of the arts. During the Khmer Rouge, a lot of Khmer dance practices were nearly extinct. And so it's something that a lot of the dance masters from the past have really worked to preserve after the end of the war.
Jenny, would you pass to someone?
Yes. So Meredith, I see that you're online. I'd love to hear from you and what's shake you.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Yat-A, Meredith Lam Yanishes Sanjinkin Shlink is a son of Bashes Chain. So I just introduced myself in Navajo, and I would say that the main cultural value that I learned, you know, my parents were leaders in the community. My dad was a medical doctor on the reservation for many years, and both my parents are Navajo. And I think Hojo is like a really, really important, way that we learned as Navajo people to function in a community. Having balance and balance and harmony. And I think that's really important. One important thing I think my dad really taught me that, you know, cultivated who I am today is the value of, like, you know, respect and how that also affects the balance of a community. And so the best advice he always gave me was, you know, you're going to have moments where you're going to enter a community that's not your own. But the best thing you can do when you enter that community is to just listen. Just listen. You don't have to, you know, give people direction. You don't have to tell people how to live their life. I mean, just the best thing you can do is just listen and see where you can help. So I really take that to heart, and I adopt that into everything that I do, you know, whether it's working with the school district or my own community, or, you know, communities that are not necessarily communities that I'm used to. It definitely is something that I definitely hold dear to my heart. And so, I do hold a lot of respect for communities that are not of my own, but also keeping that in mind, that balance and respect is really an important part of Hojo and how I live my life.
Thank you, Meredith. Rihanna, do you want to go next?
Sure. So many things come to mind, but I guess with the holidays approaching, I think I know a few other families that do this, but my mother purchased either made or purchased a Christmas ornament each year, and it was given to us. And so when we were older, we had our own ornaments, and I've continued that tradition with my family, with my girls as well, who are now grown-ups, and that's been a kind of a fun thing to pass on. And then everybody has their own things to help you decorate the tree each year too, so that's a bonus.
Thank you, Rihanna. Daniel, do you want to go next?
Sure. I was trying to think of a good one. I guess it's just going to be a family one more than anything, but sports, the Utah Utes, having come off the rivalry defeat last week, is high on my mind. But I'm not like a natural athlete by any means, and I don't even enjoy participating in most team sports, although I like skiing. But my family always would gather, you know, to watch the Utes, and even as a kid, I kind of resisted that. But as I got older, I realized this is like what we do. So I got really into it. Now I'm as into it as anyone. And we enjoy like the new hockey team and everything else. So it's kind of become a, you know, more of an excuse to get together and something to talk about every day and kind of, you know, celebrate the wins together and mourn the losses. And it brings us all closer. So I'm happy about that.
Thank you, Daniel. Taras?
I will go with one, I represent the East African community here in Northern Utah, because that's the community I work mostly. But I guess one of the cultural values that keeps me grounded and keeps me pushing to do the work that I do is being there all the time, being there for family, being there for the community. I think trust is also one big value. Be a trusted voice, being a trusted advocate for the community. We do have a a large number of East African community here in Logan. And when you see us coming together, whether it's a celebration of holiday or a wedding or a funeral or just a loss of a loved one, you see that being there and sharing whatever you have. Most of the community members do long hours off shift, usually 6 days a week. But even in those situations, they're always there for each other, for the community to be there to support. So I guess being there, no matter what, is what the cultural value that grounds me. I think that this is not just a family value; it's also more a regional community type of thing that I guess shapes the work that I do every day.
Thank you, Terhas. Dr. Nye, are you in a place where you could share? Are you?
Yep, I'm still here. Yep, okay. Still here. Thank you. One of our core values is just the sense of community, and what that really looks like is neighbors just looking after neighbors, and which extends to the broader community, regardless of whether backgrounds or circumstances might be. It's just a sense of community and looking after each other. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dr. Nye. Sean, would you mind going?
Yeah, I have a couple. One of them, I'm going to piggyback on the food and eating together. That's a huge one for my family and I. But we have a culture of service in my family, and it's across the board. And it was really instilled in me by some of my relatives in other states. I have a cousin who's a senator in Mississippi, which you can imagine how interesting that is for him and his family, and he shares insights with me on a regular basis. I have another cousin who's 82 years old now, but she was the first Black alderperson in Illinois. So we share information, we share the relationships, we maintain those relationships across the country, and discuss on a regular basis about how we serve our individual communities. And that's something that's really, dear to me. And I try to make sure I expound that in the actions and the service that I do here in the state of Utah.
Thank you, Sean.
So, I mean, food was totally taken away from me. I mean, everybody has those values around food and celebration. I also use food as a communication method with my friends, like for my friends, if they're in grief, if they're in happiness. But for my own family, I think gathering around food was a given, but it was also materialism around giving, gift giving. And for my own family, I started a tradition where I asked my children that any time of a celebration, they should write me a poem or written words and no, gifts. And that became sort of a tool for them to critique me as well. Now that has changed into, we still use spoken word as to tell our stories, but we use it to call in. And so if some of you know me, I also have this pretty loud voice in the community. And I have deliberately brought that value of calling in instead of calling out. And I'm trying every day very hard to practice.
Thank you. I'm really hoping we can continue to get to know each other, build curiosity for the communities we're from, the work that we do. There'll be an opportunity to build a little more cohesion in the commission as we start this second phase of the commission. I'll pass it to Luna and Sean to talk a little bit about the recommendations for the commission's work to date and feedback.
Sure. Sean, I'll take your lead since you started as well.
Oh, I was going to let you lead out. I did all the talking earlier.
Sure. So I am going to default first to the questionnaire that we had put in place. I'm not sure if the commission members have had a chance to look at this questionnaire. It is extremely important as we have new leadership in place now for them to know what all has been accomplished and where we want to move forward. What are our key points of learning and what are our key points around opportunity? So the questionnaire has been extended till I make this as Igor's to-do list when he speaks about the work that we're doing. But I urge each one of you to take a little time and complete that questionnaire. It would be really helpful for the commission to have a starting point.
Yeah, we received a few responses from the survey, but I would really like everybody to take the time to fill it out. If there are parts of it that you don't remember very well, feel free to just leave those blanks or to blank or to mention that you don't have specific recommendations for them. But please just take the time to go through them. Whatever recommendations that you have. I think we are statutorily required to come up with recommendations to the Lieutenant Governor. That doesn't mean that we need to come up with any recommendations, right? So I obviously want us to find, even if it's just one or two things that feel really cohesive across the responses. For example, in the responses for the schools, something that came up in all three responses was attendance. So how do we encourage attendance? What are the different ways that we can make sure that folks from communities across the board are able to attend school regularly, and where we're paying attention to what are the barriers that they're facing to attendance? So being able to get your voices into this survey so we can make sure that we are collecting recommendations and then we're able to talk about them as a commission is really vital. Luna, Sean, are there any other recommendations or anything you saw that you would want to bring up?
I have not taken the survey myself. So
okay.
I'll be the first one with the same face say that. But I do commit to completing it. I would love to have a quick sort of roundabout around how and what are the priorities for each commission member at this time. We did have a cadence of going through different agencies and departments and learning about them. And in this moment where we are, I'd love for each one to summarize probably in a quick 30-second as to where and what you think is the information that the community requires at the moment that the commission should prioritize in bringing those departments or agencies to the commission. I'm just going to popcorn it to Meredith. Sorry for putting you on spot.
Are you able to hear me right now?
Yes.
I haven't taken the survey as well. I think this has just been like a really busy time, but are you looking for specific suggestions for truancy or absenteeism?
That's part of the conversation around the survey, but the current question that I'm asking each commission member is, what do you think should be a priority or priorities for the next group or set of meetings that we want to set up? What in, from your community is of utmost importance in this current moment?
I think right now, for sure, it would definitely be, you know, healthcare is always like a concern for urban Native Americans. I think because rural Native Americans have access to the Indian Health Services, I think that the urban natives here in the Utah area, especially like Salt Lake and North, there's not a whole lot of access or just like as far as services that are available, I think people don't know the resources that are available, and I think that that's really important. Housing is also another thing, you know, that is a major problem, I think, just statewide. But in particular, I would definitely say, like, health concerns and just, like, healthcare concerns, that would be, you know, probably that's always a priority. And I think just with this current political climate, people are just wondering how that's going to change.
I think that that is going to be like a number one factor, you know, as far as people, Native community members, like, I've seen a lot of them move back to the reservation just because once that access gets like cut off, you know, you have no choice but to go back to where you can afford to live. And so it's becoming more expensive to live here in Utah. I think especially for the urban Native American population. So I think that that would be the number one concern.
Thank you. Anybody else, please feel free to jump in.
Can I go?
Please, go ahead, Taras.
I guess, yeah, just to add on Meredith's housing and healthcare, for most of the refugee and immigrant communities that I work with in Northern Utah right now, this week is more of the food security. I work with many low-income families. We do have a community food bank, but with what's going on with the government shutdown and other, there is fear. It's not just the food insecurity part, but it's more, that is actually layered in the other fear, like not knowing what's happening, not knowing. And most of the families came from war areas where there was trauma, where there was like, it was a normal experience for them to go through insecure governments, where is it like war, displacement. And I think there is a lot of fear in the community, and now this couple of weeks is additionally food insecurity. I guess I know this commission, we had five priorities we focused last session. Is there any advocacy work that we can do at least to ease this fear in our communities? This has to do with the political environment, and I don't know how we can kind of try to tackle some of the fears, whether by bringing someone to, you know, I don't know, some. And the big thing we live in a smaller communities, and there is fear, there is not feeling safe to go places. I guess I don't know how this commission can address that, but this is what my community is facing at this time.
Thank you.
Taras, can I just ask you a follow-up question? You had mentioned the uncertainty that the community is feeling, just that they don't know what's going on. And then you also mentioned that they're scared to go anywhere. Are those two separate things or are those connected?
They are connected. There is not knowing. There is also misinformation. So they will hear something about there will be ICE in town. And I work with communities who have a protected status, immigration status mostly. But there is that confusion even with students who have green card, who are at the universities. They have that fear of like, we don't know anything. We don't know what's going to happen. There is lack of information. There is also a pocket of small misinformation that's creating fear in those communities.
Thank you. Brianna, go ahead.
Thanks, Igor. I did take the survey, and it was a lot. I was like, whoa, I have to remember from way far back. So it was, you know, and some of the things I was kind of honest about, the information I got in that hour and a half, I don't feel like I have enough information to really give a recommendation, especially if it's not a sector that I work in a lot. But I think the things that I can speak to, I also work with immigrant populations and, you know, high poverty in rural southeastern Utah here. And I think, you know, the basics, like the food, health, and housing, I'll echo what I'm hearing here. And some of the things that I've talked to you about, Igor, and I put in my report is expanding training and certification for language access. And I think that that will reach a lot of different sectors. We have that certification for medical interpretation, but the state made it more complicated than it used to be and more expensive, especially for small nonprofits like mine to keep in interpreters trained and certified, even though its certification is voluntary, but it raises the bar for a lot of multicultural communities when you have these language professionals that are not just in their healthcare system, but in their schools, and when state agencies like DCFS or the police need to get involved. So I think having a community interpreter certification would cross all of these sectors and get employment for a lot of multicultural populations, as well as just liaisonship, because I just see how powerful that has been in my community to reach. When you have advocates and cultural brokers and language interpreters, they wear a lot of hats, and especially with law enforcement, there's a lot, I think, to be done there working with language interpreters, because sometimes they forgo it because of the cost, and I think we can do a lot of work there.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I'll jump in quickly. One of the things that we're starting to see is a significant increase in hate crimes in our communities, and people, you know, to Terrace and Rihanna's points, people are just not feeling safe. I think that the commission has an opportunity here to work closely with law enforcement, as stated, to develop just opportunities for understanding across different barriers and bridging those relationships. This work was done in the past, and I know that we have public safety as one of our future visits with the agency, but we want to find, I think it would be important to find a way to touch bases with all of our local law enforcement folks as well, and help them understand that they're a part of the solution. And I would like to see something developed by the commission that we can actually take out and disseminate amongst communities once we get this ball rolling with law enforcement and those in public service, to be able to create an environment of trust. And that's a big part of feeling safe, is having trust within each of the communities. And that's probably the biggest thing that I'm hearing from people in my community, is just not feeling safe and worried about where the next incident's gonna happen. Our faith community is another one that's really fearful of, hate crimes and other actions coming to them. And we've seen that lately in some of the incidents that have taken place across the country. So, I'm looking forward to our meeting with our public safety folks, but that one there is probably the biggest one for us right now.
Thank you, Sean. If anybody else wants to speak, otherwise I have some comments too.
I can jump in just from a state agency perspective that serves statewide on a lot of these things. I mean, I wasn't prepared to answer this question specifically. I think that we have an obligation at the state level to do what we can to make sure that we're serving all of the populations. I think one of the things that's on our mind and has been on our minds for quite some time is somehow figuring out, and we haven't been able to do it yet, how our policies, largely policies, because that's what we control, are impacting certain populations. And I always use the example of child welfare, because it's so disproportionate in which race and ethnicities are represented in the child welfare system. So we haven't figured out how to do it yet. But it's top of mind. I mean, we have the Office of American Indian, Alaska Native Health and Family Services, and I think that's an area where we are hoping that we can start reviewing our administrative rules. So that's just top of mind for us, is like, you could have the best intentions of serving the entire state and the best intentions of creating rules and policies, and then in their practice and in their implementation, they just don't get carried out that way. So
That's just something that we're really focused on. And I think, our ability to communicate and connect with the various populations statewide that utilize our services is incredibly important. How do you figure out how to rely on your partners, your community partners to carry that message? So we're not always the best messengers. So we have a lot of services and a lot of resources, but they don't get to the right populations.
And I kind of wanted to allude to not only just the challenges from our community. Law enforcement is a huge concern right now. The ICE raids and, once again, the job market itself, is a huge concern. But as far as the commission work is concerned, I also would like to see, and you've alluded to this, Tracy, how do we actually provide information around the policy that already exists in the state? So, for example, we do have hate crime, let's say legislature approved certain sort of information. And how is that getting implemented? Do communities understand how to report a hate crime? And what's the difference between a hate incident and a hate crime? I'm trying to, and that kind of goes across all different departments. Law enforcement has certain, preventive measures. How do we take that information from the commission to our communities? I feel like as we find more information, we also create pathways of taking that information deeper into the community. So I'm just throwing that out there to us as commissioners to think about. We do have access to a lot of information through this commission, and how do we create solid pathways of taking it back to our community? And whereas also advocating for the resources that our community does need. I'm not going to shy away for asking for more information or asking for changes in policies, recommendations around that as well. So please be thinking about this. Please let's, revisit this as we create an outline of the next steps. Have these in your mind, and let's come back and discuss this further. Do we want to? I'm going to move on to the next. If anybody has any other comments, please feel free to jump in right now.
Yeah, I would like to just at least offer one for consideration as we're thinking about statewide and that education space, particularly the kindergarten through third grade. So, reading at grade level proficiency rates for the state for third graders hovers around 50%. And, of course, as we disaggregate these data, we identify, of course, that a lot of our English language learner students are still struggling in that space. And the legislature has taken a couple pieces of significant action recently. As we take a look at policy and reflect on the outcomes of it, two pieces. One, they created an add-on and a weighted pupil unit for funding. And then two, even this last session, Representative Perucci passed House Bill 42, which allocates about $500,000 to schools where they're seeing a significant increase in English language learner students so they can receive those services to help them with their literacy and command of English. So I think there's more efforts that need to be done in that regard as we consider some of our youngest students who are still struggling at school.
Thank you, Dr. Nye.
Thank you as well. So the request for updated information from agencies. Is that what we've covered around new different changes that have happened in everything? Is there any specific request of any specific agencies from the commissioners that we would like, our director to go and solicit at this moment, apart from what we talked about? Is there anything specific from the commissioners?
I think one of the things that there's nothing game talk today specific, but just getting an update from agencies as things have changed, either through the legislature or through the services that they provide based on, shifts in services that, they can and cannot provide for individuals. You know, I think of things like, what's happening right now with SNAP, and, getting in to those agencies to be able to outline to people exactly what the changes are, how it will impact recipients, and somehow pushing that information out to our communities. I think as commissioners, that's one of our tasks that we're charged with, is to share with these communities. But having that information available to us so that we can disseminate it, I think would be really great to help us to, begin to continue that building of that connection and bridge with the commission and our community members.
So in that context, I have a question, a wild one that I've not talked to anybody. Just putting it out there to try it out. I'm wondering, as we go through the next set of meetings with different agencies, if I know there are wonderful staff is also creating newsletters around after every meeting where all the resources are listed. And I'm wondering if every commissioner can take a turn in introducing in that newsletter about that agency, take ownership of distributing that, when it comes from you, I think it makes a difference. And if every commissioner can take one of the newsletters during the year, adopt it, and help disseminate, I think it might give us all a pathway to, not only work closely with the staff, but also help the other commissioners see how the dissemination can be personalized and have deeper penetration. I'm not sure if this needs a vote. I'm just throwing this out as an idea.
So is the idea like at one of the newsletters, our department would take ownership of writing the actual newsletter?
No, so as a summary of every meeting, a newsletter is generated, is my understanding, from the MCA staff, right?
Yep, it's a brief that summarizes exactly the resources and main points that was covered in the commission meeting. It is also available on the website as well. And so it's developed through a resource we call PEMA, just so it's easy to have all the links captured in one place as well. But it should be accessible for anyone to access on our website as well.
I guess my question would be, just based on that, do we know kind of like what the opening rate is or click-through rate is of the newsletter? Are we sure that the newsletter is actually meeting the needs of the populations that we're trying to reach, as a first question, before we start determining that it's the right tool to provide the information? I think we would be happy. I mean, we want to get information out about our department and what's available. And to Sean's point, a lot of changes. I mean, SNAP is a time-limited change. We always aren't the best people to know how to get that information out or what the information should even say. So there's a part of in my mind about, like, is there a role for the Multicultural Commission to play in how to best connect with communities? But if we're going to be, if the staff, you or the staff in general are going to be producing a newsletter, are the contents of the newsletter adding value to our populations? And are they opening it and reading it and utilizing the information? And if not, then what content should be in the newsletter? Should there be another tool?
Yeah.
So, I was just going to add that I feel like that's one of the questions that I would really like to try and figure out is what are our current connections to communities across Utah, and how are we receiving information from them regularly, and how are we distributing information back to them?
Okay, so my understanding is this newsletter was actually created the summary, I wouldn't call it a deserved summary of that award. Summary was created in consensus with all the current commissioners in the last cycle. We went through this discussion of saying, we are receiving so much of resources and information in these meetings, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided that staff will actually put a summary together and hand it to every commissioner to then be able to take it to the different communities that they represent. What I am at this moment coming in and trying to create a bridge on is saying, yes, maybe we check on the data as to see if this summary is actually being utilized or how big is the distribution list and so on, but also then you have a cadence of every commissioner actually have sort of like an introduction, have a rotating introduction on, let's say, in December, whatever meeting we have, Sean is the person featured in that summary and also tasked with taking it deeper into the community. And then we revisit the data to see if we had more clicks and everything. And the month after, another commissioner is featured and is tasked with taking it further, deeper into their particular community. And that way our database will not only keep building, but it'll give the commission members an ownership, you know, to do outreach in specific ways. I'm just trying to put a structure in place for deeper penetration.
Yeah. Thank you.
I like that. Can I make one more suggestion? It's hard to get people to go to the website. So if we can put it in a format that we can share in our social medias, can we share in our in other ways with folks that are within our community to share prior to meetings, even a digital copy, that if we know there's a community meeting going to happen, that we can give that to those leaders to be able to have them sift through and see if they want to pull information out for the gathering that they're having. I think that would be really great. It's the easier the information is to capture and share, the more folks that we're going to be able to touch. Simplicity is the way.
So it feels like that's a good follow-up item around the question of how are we compiling the information? How are we getting out? We can also look into how many people were looking at the newsletters we were sending out before.
Yeah. And I can double check those numbers, but it was mostly the newsletter from this commission was being sent out mostly to commission members, guests who also presented on the information, and then I think a few additional members. It wasn't sent to our general audience with MCA. I can also check the website to see how many people are engaging with those links. But I can tell you the engagement rate is most likely pretty low because it was mostly shared with the commission members here to then further share. But I think tying in Sean's point of finding the best method that makes it easiest for you all to be able to share within your networks, we can explore, like, maybe instead of this kind of newsletter format, a 1-to-2-page PDF. That way you can easily share on your socials, emails, and stuff like that. But that would make it a little trickier to track the data. But I think just knowing that you're connecting with your personal networks, I think that can help get a better chance of success and outreach.
Right. So if we are not able to track that data, for example, if I'm using it on my socials, and if there's an option for folks to register for the newsletter, is that a mechanism?
Yeah, we can utilize that.
And that way our sort of database can grow.
Mm-hmm. And if you all are sharing on your social media, you are also able to see who is, like, clicking on your own social media posts. And so there's a way for us to kind of get some data that way, too.
And so, you know, if I'm featured on the newsletter, it just motivates me more to share it. And that's what I'm also encouraging every commission member to then adopt. And we can probably choose which specific agency we'd like to champion at this moment, which has more value for our community, and brainstorm more about it, which is, like I said, sorry for off-agenda item and experimenting a little.
I think it's a great thing for us to follow up and talk about. Figure out how to do that.
I would throw in there not just highlighting us as individual commission members, but the diverse communities throughout the state, maybe you have a feature of one of the commission members, but then also a feature of a particular community, their cultural values, their cultural traditions, because I think part of the challenge we have in our state is a lot of our populations are very, very small, and the vast majority of our state aren't familiar with the unique attributes and the breadth of the various communities that are represented. And if we're going to take an effort, like, we put out so much resource information, I hesitate just at the department level, and I know that's different at the community level, for us to add one more document that we're putting out there. But if it's a way for people to be educated and understand about all of the populations in our state, I might be a little bit more inclined to do that, because that's not something we're doing at the department level. And we want to foster understanding and celebration. So maybe just adding that to the mix, if we're going to have a conversation about the newsletter and getting it out, figuring out if there's other hooks, because I think you're right. You're more inclined to post it if it's about yourself, but you're also more inclined to post it if you're highlighting something about your community as well.
Absolutely. And I think in that note, I would also encourage us to actually look at the interfaith calendar and mark the holidays. I've been saying this for a very long time. The commission should take it upon themselves to represent different celebrations, a message from the lieutenant governor or the governor, and kind of make it part of our messaging.
Great idea.
I think he tries.
I think that's where the commission.
He posted about Diwali. If it's
I know I worked for the Ramadan piece with him, and they always do.
They do it if they know.
But I think if that becomes part of our communications too, it helps. This is another touch point with these diverse communities.
Yeah, and to your point, sorry, I know we're going down a little bit of a road. We have a challenge that we don't have trust about what our department does, and there's kind of lack of understanding. And so we have this, like, we got to put out good stories, because when the bad stories happen, if that's all the public knows. And I think there's a similar challenge, not that there's bad stories, but there's so much positive to tell. In getting, just in subtle ways, talking about the holidays and the culture and having the governor and the lieutenant governor acknowledge them, as opposed to it's about getting more resources to these communities, and that these communities just need so many resources and so much assistance, which may be true, but it's not the exclusive narrative that we want for our state. And there are so many rich opportunities to have a positive narrative and foster understanding in big and subtle ways that could really make a huge impact, I think.
All right. I'm going to move us back onto our timeline. And I think the next agenda item is the meeting schedule. John, if you want to put that over for the commission.
Yeah. I wanted to get with the commission members and find out what your thoughts are on our meeting schedule is, and where I'm going is, you know, thinking about, do we want to have bi-monthly meetings? Do we want to have quarterly meetings? Quarterly, I think, is too long. Or do we want to have monthly meetings and continue with monthly meetings, so that we can start to get this information, learn ourselves about the mission of the commission itself and the multicultural community. There's so much that we have to do and have to get out that I wanted to get to everybody else, but I'm about the monthly meetings for at least a couple of months, and then maybe decide if we go bi-monthly after that. But I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I got some feedback from everybody here on what you think about meeting schedules and how to do that. And then we also have to consider, you know, what's coming up. Everybody's mentioned the holiday season. the holiday season in the summer is when there's a lot of folks in and out of town, and it'll be difficult to get everybody to get to the meeting. So a quorum becomes a difficult task. So I just wanted to throw that out and see what thoughts you had on a schedule for meetings here.
This is Rhianna from OAB. I sit on a lot of other boards and commissions, and I don't know if I would have the capacity for monthly meetings, but I would certainly do my very best.
Yeah. So bi-monthly might work best for you then.
That would work best for me, but I'm just, just me. Yeah.
I live the life you live, so.
if I can go, I also have a time challenge, but I also feel responsible at this moment, having had such a time lag with this commission, just the fact that we are, you know, once again going into a process of reinvigorating our entire work, I feel very strongly that we should go into a monthly for at least 6 months and then taper it down so that we can accelerate. And I know it's going to be a challenge for me to show up every month. But for the sake of the commission and, you know, the steam that is needed at this moment, I feel like I need to make that recommendation.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, just a question maybe. I think going to a monthly cadence is great when there's clear kind of objectives. And so maybe it would be helpful to understand if we went to a monthly cadence, what objectives would we want to accomplish over 6 months? I don't disagree that, you know, kind of resetting and reinvigorating the commission and trying to figure out what our objectives are and what our purpose is isn't important. I think it's incredibly important. But making time on a monthly basis, with so many of us having so many time challenges, if we're going to do that, being very, very clear on what we're trying to accomplish every time we get together, and possibly making those meetings maybe an hour long if we're going to do it monthly, and surging on a monthly basis when there's an important objective and then tapering off. I love that idea because the statutory requirements, what, quarterly? Is it quarterly that this commission meets? Oh, well, that might be something to check.
Yeah.
It's probably a minimum. My guess is it's a minimum of quarterly.
Mm-hmm. We can check on that. I also wonder around the question about clear objectives and goals for the commission, if it might be helpful for us to have a retreat, some sort of meeting where we set those objectives and goals for the year. And then once we have a clear idea of what those objectives and goals are, then we might be able to say, you know, we really do need to meet once a month or once every 2 months. Makes more sense, all things considered.
So my reason for proposing monthly meeting right now is actually to get to have those discussions as to what is it that we need to work on. And so if the meetings are pushed out 2 months, this is how long it's going to take for us to decide. I feel at this moment where the commission stands, we don't have that questionnaire to be able to fall back and say, this is what the commissioners want to work on. So putting these meetings on a calendar will expedite that discussion. And retreat, all I'm going to say is good luck finding time. I'm wondering if an hour a month is a better way to get accelerated rather than, you know, trying to find half a day on everybody's calendar to go to retreat.
Yes. And those, sorry, Sean, I keep interrupting you. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, you know, if we did our meeting once a month for a short while, we could do those on Zoom or here on Google Meet. And I think we can get a lot accomplished that way. But I want to go back to what Igor said about a retreat. One of the things that I am adamant about whenever I work with any group, committee or anything is the fact that, you know, we need to know each other. So we need to know each other's needs. We need to get to know each other. So I think a retreat that would allow us to do that would also help us in putting together some guidance as to what we want to do. But it gives us a chance to know each other and our communities that we're serving and how we can best, ride smoothly through the intersections that exist and to be able to serve in the best way possible.
So I know we're at time. Do we want to set the next meeting and then continue this conversation then?
Yeah.
So when should the next meeting be? Thank you, Tracy.
Since everybody likes food, somebody can cook us Thanksgiving dinner and we'll just have Thanksgiving together. No.
We did all want to cook and eat together.
I am happy to jump in and host if somebody else can figure out a schedule.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to cook for everyone. I always am.
Always kidding. I was kidding. What does the 18th of November look like for everyone?
I'm good that day, after 10.
This moment, I can say yes.
Works for me.
Yeah, I can make that work.
Afternoon is better, but I could move something in the morning, too, if everyone wanted to do morning.
Or we could keep it at the same time, if that works.
Yep, I can make that work.
Denny, can we plan on that?
Go ahead, Sean.
I was just asking Jenny if we can plan on this time on the 18th.
Yes, I will send a reminder to everyone. This boardroom is not available, but we can move over to another meeting space if required. And then while we have a quorum still, would the commission like to go back and approve the minutes from May?
So I don't think we have a quorum because...
Tracy's on the phone.
Right, but isn't...
I'm on the phone.
Yeah, but Daniel is a designee, right?
There's seven. There's just still seven. There's still seven.
Oh, we're still good? Okay.
Yeah. I make the motion to approve the meeting minutes from... November 18th? May 27th,
2025. I'll second.
Okay, and then if we could get a roll call vote.
First?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Present.
Emma Gardner is not present. Tracy?
Aye.
Meredith? Meredith, would you vote to approve the minutes? Maybe we'll come back to Meredith. Rihanna?
Aye.
Jefferson's not here. Wayne's not here. Sean?
Aye.
Kevin's not here. Dr. Nye?
Aye.
Terras? Terras, do you vote to approve the minutes?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now. Thank you. And then Meredith, are you still with us?
That puts us short if she's not.
Meredith, in your mute, you are speaking.
Would you try chatting, Meredith?
We can vote at the next meeting, too.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah.
The motion did not pass.
No.
The lack of quorum.
Not enough votes.
Not enough votes. So we will defer this to the next meeting. I'll make a motion to adjourn the meeting for today.
Thanks. I'll talk to Tom.
I'll make the motion to adjourn.
He just doesn't mean.
Is that Tracy?
Yes.
Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, thank you all. Looking forward to seeing you in the next meeting.
Great. Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
2:30 already started.
I know, me too. I got to drive to my. Luna, thank you so much for coming.